The construction industry in Indiana has depended on Quality Supply and Tool, a local family-owned business, to deliver quality sales and service over the last 25 years. The employees make the difference, like sales expert Nick Worley.
What sets us apart is we only offer quality tools and supplies from quality manufacturers. We have a quality trained sales and service staff knowledgeable of the products we sell and offer. Quality. It's in our name.
On South Harding Street in Indy, plus Bloomington and Jeffersonville, Quality Supply and Tool thinks outside the box. Store.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it.
Beyond the Bricks with jQuery and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5. The Fan.
From inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, my name is jQuery. Good evening to you. This show is Beyond the Bricks, which is a look at all of, primarily via audio, the history of kind of the behind-the-scenes things that made the Indianapolis 500 what it is. It goes without saying that the speed of the cars, the bravery of the drivers, the ingenuity of the engineers, and the craftsmanship of the mechanics would be what made the Indianapolis 500 the greatest race in the world. But all of that needed to be shared with the world, and we take a look back at kind of those personalities that helped do exactly that. Mike Thompson compiles all of the audio for this program, and Eddie Garrison tonight is working essentially as the mechanic that puts it all together. But Mike, let's begin with this as we continue a look back at some anniversary years. I want to, as we do from time to time, reset just exactly your involvement in this show, because I don't think that it can be overstated the importance in terms of not only the audio library that you have, and for those that don't know, you live in a 62,000 square foot mansion, 61,990 feet of which is audio library, and then you have a small cot in the very back of it. But to be able to go out and pull the audio and put together and piece together the storylines that we share, that's all the backbone work that you do, but it is really remarkable to hear the voices and hear the stories of the race coming out of, vocally, those that were involved even so much as 100 years ago.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun to be able to pull audio, like, you know, we're going to hear Peter DiPaolo in a little bit, and then we mentioned Fred Frame the other night, and just to have even a small sound clip of some of these people that, you know, they're fairly remote figures sometimes if you think about it, because they're, you know, they won so many years ago, but the fact that it's preserved and we're able to share it, you know, that's what I really enjoy about the program. I mean, there's two things I really like about the program. Well, three things, really. One is the reaction we get from the folks at home when they come up and talk to you and I both about it. Two is getting to work with you, Jake, because that is the highlight of one of my things of the year, because, you know, we have a lot of fun together doing this show, and that it really means a lot to me. And three, it's just getting the chance to share this audio with folks and you know, get it out of the 80,000 square foot mansion or wherever I apparently live in. And I, you know, as I do have a number of, you know, drives, you know, those solid state drives, SSD drives. I've got a lot of those that have audio on it. So that does take up a lot of my house. Unfortunately, I wish I had about 60,000 more square feet than I have.
Well, we've got another 100 years to compile audio, perhaps, Mike. We shall see if we become as, I guess, never-ending as the Indianapolis 500. But let's go back to 100 years ago. Now, the 1925 Indianapolis 500 was run on May 30th of 1925. It was the 13th running of the International Sweepstakes, as it was known in the time. Peter DiPaolo would win a race that featured 22 starters. This was before the customary, if you will, field of 33. But what was of note was that DiPaolo was the race winner, but he was joined by Dave Lewis and Phil Schaefer on the quote-unquote podium, the top three. But it was of note because those three drivers, all three, turned in an average exceeding 100 miles per hour. That was the first time that had happened in the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Donald Davidson is the historian emeritus of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. shares his thoughts on the 1925 race.
For the first time, the Indianapolis 500 was won in a time of under 5 hours. It was like 4 hours and 56 minutes and something. Average speed, 101.13. So not too long before that, a 100-mile-an-hour lap was quite an accomplishment. And now they were going the distance at that speed. Peter DiPaolo, the nephew of Ralph DiPalma, who now thoroughly stamped himself as the leading driver, was the winner for Duesenberg. He took 21 laps of relief from Norman Batten, but while he had his hands had to be bandaged because of blisters, and 21 laps doesn't sound like much, but in terms of time then, that was probably 35, 40 minutes, enough time for DiPalma to just take a stretch and get bandaged up. So he did finish the race, and Norman Batten typically is not mentioned in the results column because of the fact that DiPaolo had started the race and finished the race, and Batten just drove the interim, but relief drivers probably should get more credit than they did. The second place finishing car was quite unique in that it was front drive, and front drive was by no means a new idea, but it was new at the Indianapolis Speedway. And there's a bit of a story here. Jimmy Murphy, who had won the 500 in 22 and was on his way to winning the national championship for a second time, he won the championship in 22 and then again in 24, and at some time apparently during the summer of 24, he had conversation with Harry Miller and said, as the track gets more slippery with oil being deposited, wouldn't front drive be an advantage at the speedway? And so Harry Miller probably said yes. And so one thing led to another. And Jimmy Murphy, this is before the days of taxes, and Murphy was winning a lot of money winning on board tracks. And so he was now in a position to, well, he already owned his own car, but now he's in a position to go further. And so, long story short on that one, he commissioned a car from Harry Miller to build a front drive car. Murphy was fatally injured at Syracuse, New York dirt track on September the 15th, and the job was already in progress, and Cliff Durant, who was the son of Billy Durant, but Cliff Durant drove in the 500 and was very much of a supporter of racing, paid to have the car finished up. And it was entered for the 25 race with Dave Lewis as the driver, and it was car number one. And you frequently see mention of the fact that number one was on there in tribute to Jimmy Murphy as the posthumous national champion. That's not exactly what happened. It was the first entry to come in is why it has number one. And I think it's the following year when they finally started to number the cars according to the driver's finish in the previous year's national champion. But that's sort of a good story for 25, but that's not exactly what happened. This was the first year that there was broadcasting of any consequence at the track. The earliest transmissions from the track were 1922, but they were very much amateur in nature. But by 1925, there were two stations. There was WFBM from Indianapolis, and I think their transmitter and studios, I think, were in the Athletic Club. I may be wrong on that. And then the other one was WGN Chicago, believe it or not. And those were both broadcasting 500 coverage from the track in 1925 from the pagoda.
Mike, a couple of interesting things about Peter DiPaolo winning in 1925. One of them, as we know, he would return in 1971 to sing Back Home Again in Indiana. That's one of the moments that lives in Beyond the Bricks infamy, correct?
That is one of the truly great moments in the history of this show, is getting to share that fine singing, you know, and Sid saying Pete DiPaolo with a gallant job on that. So yeah, that is a beyond the moments, beyond the bricks, all time Hall of Fame moment. But yeah, that, and then the clip we're about to play, the famous $100 interview that Pete DiPaolo gave. I think that's one of your favorite clips as well.
All right, here we go.
All through the race, I had the confidence that I was going to win. Matter of fact, I'd sing. I'd go down the backstretch singing, oh, boy, I'm lucky. I'll say I'm lucky. Get over, buddy, let me by. I didn't say nice words all the time, but it was very, very interesting. And they all thought I was going too fast. And the weather was terribly hot. It was 96 temperature. So you can imagine what the track temperature must have been. They said he'll never make it, he'll never hold it. But as a matter of fact, after the first 25 laps, I could look back the entire length of the home stretch, nobody in sight. And that's where I tell them I enjoy my most pleasant thrill. Every time I cross a line, all alone, $100, $100, $100, it was a marvelous feeling.
That's actually, it's, I don't know if people know this, but each year when we do this show, $100, right? That's exactly how it works.
I'm lucky to get $100. So, I mean, I would take $100 at this point because I'm lucky to even get that. But yeah, $100. It was marvelous.
That's why we do the show. Let's be real here, right? All right, let's go from 1925 to, so we're going to flash forward right now. We get right there, I guess, actually in one of the 100 mile an hour cars, and we get picked up a couple $100 here because we're going to go to 1965. For the 1965 Indianapolis 500, race took place May 31st of that year. That, of course, would be the 49th running of the Indianapolis 500. And the 1965 race, Mike, what's interesting about this one is for a race that obviously, you know, sees Jim Clark win, so there's a lot of history there. You clearly have the Lotus in terms of a car that people still talk about. But in terms of the talk of the 1965 race, not a lot of audio compared to other races.
That's correct. It's an unusual situation. When I worked at the facility in the infield and we were doing the transcription disc project, the one race that was absolutely missing, there was no box of transcription discs for, was 1965. So that race, there was no lacquer discs that we could get, you know, preserved or anything like that. They weren't there. And so it's been a race that's been very difficult to piece together. There have been in the tape trading community for years a couple very, very low quality copies of the race, but they're very difficult to work with, to be candid with you, because you'll have a few minutes where Sid is, I mean, you can hear it very, very well, and then it goes into an audio that you couldn't use at all. So it's, unfortunately, there's no, to my knowledge, there's no complete copy of the 1965 radio broadcast that's usable in any form. I mean, we've got some clips and we were able to piece together a couple clips here and there, but we don't, as we do with many of the other years, we don't have a complete race to work with, unfortunately.
So the clips put together become a montage, the montage of 1965.
It's almost race time, and you can hear as they go by, there's the front row. But it's not race time till the flag drops at the starting line about a half to three-eighths of a mile away. Imagine the excitement with each of these drivers. This is a magic moment, and now to bring you up to date, our chief announcer, his 18th year, here is Sid Collins.
Jim, thank you. The moment is upon us. The vibration running up and down the spine. Here they come.
He's completed one lap. He's come across now for the second lap because he crossed the line going in the pits. And if Luke Walton can get down that way, we'll pick him up. And let's take Jim here on the number four turn. Jimmy?
They're about on you again, so I'll go back to you.
We'll pick him up, and here they come. And Floyd has taken the lead now. Bud Clark, followed by Gurney and Jones and Al Miller. That's the top five after two laps. And we're having trouble down here with number two. he is still going in the STP gas treatment car, but the big Novi, the most powerful car on the track with Herdebees, and Andy Granatelli waves his hand. And what did that mean to you, Freddie, when he put his hand over the hood there? Does that mean it's out, or what does he mean by that?
Well, it looks like they're in trouble.
Well, they say that Green and Peanuts are unlucky. I don't think he's eaten many peanuts, but he does have a green car, and boy, he has done a magnificent job today with that. Sid Collins, he's coming into your view, and here he is.
And here he comes, and here is the checkered flag for Jimmy Clark of Doon, Scotland, winner of the 1965 Indianapolis 500 mile race.
Speedway historian emeritus Donald Davidson, his thoughts on the 1965 race.
In 1965, to everyone's relief, after a really tragic 1964 race and with the Sachs-McDonald accident and then several alarming things that happened after that, in 1965, quite the reverse. Everybody was kind of on edge. And the race was probably the most trouble-free maybe ever. There was only one wall contact, and that was Bud Tinglestead, who I think was running third at just past the halfway mark and had a wheel come off and hit the wall. And that was the only contact of the day. The race was won by Jim Clark with the English Lotus. The third year for Lotus to be there and the second year for the double overhead camshaft Ford V8 engine, normally aspirated. And Clark had pretty much the day to himself. He had temporarily won the pole and got knocked off the pole by Foyt. And when they came down for the start, Clark led. And then Foyt passed him at the end of the first lap or the second lap. And then Clark was quickly back in front. So Foyt just led the one lap there. And it looked like it was a real battle between the two. And Clark later said, I was just curious to see what he had. And then a little bit later during a pit stop, Foyt led for nine laps. So he led 10 and Clark led the rest of the way. So, I mean, effectively, he led practically the whole race. When Foyt dropped out just past the halfway mark with a transmission problem, he was running second, but Clark clearly had the lead, and then Clark just pretty much cruised from that point on and was the first person to win with a rear-engine car, led 190 laps, averaged over 150 miles an hour. So we'd gone from the track record being 150 miles an hour to just 3 years later, that was the race distance speed. Parnelli Jones finished second in a rear-engine car, the car that Clark had put on the pole the year before. And then third was the first of a really stellar rookie group. There were 11 rookies, and in third place was Mario Andretti, and fifth was Gordon Johncock, and ninth was Al Unser. And so they were the three standouts of that group. And a good year had been there the year before and had withdrawn just before the first qualifying day, but this year they stuck it out, and the final count was that Goodyear had 12 cars and Firestone the remainder. There had been other companies there in 64, but this year there were only the two. This was the first year for ABC to be on the grounds. They did not broadcast the race live. This was the second year for MCA closed-circuit television. But ABC was on the grounds, and they taped material to be broadcast a week later on the Wide World of Sports program on Saturday afternoon, which they did for the next several years. And one really quite notable point about the starting field was that Roger Ward was too slow to qualify and was the first alternate starter. And at the time, that was stunning because between 1959 and 1964, he had finished first, second, third, first, and second, and then was the first alternate. And at the time, I thought, boy, that adds, I mean, that's amazing. That's stunning that Roger Ward wouldn't be in the field. But it added a lot of credibility to the way the starting field was made up, because there was no provisionals and it was the fastest 33. And as great a champion as ever raced at the Speedway, missed it by one spot. And was he spirited into the field somehow? No, he was not.
Mike, as we take a look back, 1925, 1965, now it's time to get a little bit groovy on the other side. What do you say we step into the 70s as we take a look back at some of the anniversary years and, let's say, 50 years ago? Sound good to you?
That sounds good to me. But the only problem is the other night you mentioned tough skin pants, and my mother used to make me wear those all the time. And so I'm kind of a little scared of that. You gave me a little PTSD from tough skin pants.
Well, listen, it's better than the Huskies, right? You didn't have to wear the Huskies. But at least with the tough skins, you didn't break through the knees. You could allow for a little more slipping, sliding, and skidding. You would have been an excellent tire changer in 1975, which is the exact race we'll talk about when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and tired of dealing with the indifference of big corporate suppliers, Quality Supply and Tool on South Harding Street understands. For over 25 years, owner Kevin Ane has had a different approach.
We at Quality Supply and Tool take pride in being a locally owned family business committed to service. And every customer's needs are different, and we truly believe in shaping our business to our customers' needs. That's what separates us from the competition.
That's Quality Supply and Tool, with additional locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to serve Hoosiers better. Partner with Quality Supply and Tool and think outside the box. Store.
Have you heard? AT&T Fiber with Wi-Fi is coming soon. We're talking internet speeds up to 5 gigs and Wi-Fi that reaches more corners of your home. Perfect for turning your basement into a streaming zone or your attic into a gaming cave. Sign up for updates and be the first to know when it's available near you so you can start living like a gigillionaire. Limited availability. May require AT&T extended Wi-Fi coverage. Visit att.com/internet/fiber is coming for updates. Wired speed maximum 4.7 gigabits per second. Speeds vary, not guaranteed.
This is Beyond the Bricks on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, Jake Query, along with Mike Thompson, Eddie Garrison as well. It is Beyond the Bricks as we do an anniversary night, if you will, going back 50 years ago now to the year 1975. May 25th was the date that the 59th Indianapolis 500-mile race would run. And the reality is, Mike, it was a year that experienced what had seen 2 years before, and that is the fact that there were plenty of races seemingly in the 70s or even days in the 70s where Mother Nature decided that she needed a little more time to be able to get things going at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, because a lot of sitting and waiting due to rain back in those days.
Yeah, there was a streak of bad luck with rain. 73, obviously, 75, 76. I mean, they ran into a stretch of bad races with a bad rain situations in those races. So you're right. I mean, 1975, people may forget that ended with a true downpour. I mean, an absolute thunderstorm ended that race.
The 1975 race would become Bobby Unser's second win. He had won it, of course, already in 1968. He would win again in 1981. But the montage of how it sounded in 1975.
33 powerful racing machines are straining to be let loose as they leave turn four and head down the main straightaway. Now here they come for the world's fastest flying start. We're watching Pat Vidan. The green flag is out, and the 1975 Indianapolis 500-mile race is on. Turn one, Ron Carroll.
All right, Sid, and it's going to be Gordon Shadcock taking the lead. A.J. Boyd right behind him. Bobby Unser, then Lloyd Ruby in turn two. Honey Bell.
Yep, it is Gordon Shadcock. A.J. Boyd in second spot. Bobby Unser in third. Then it's Lloyd Ruby, Tom Sneva, and there's Johnny Rutherford. And now to Jerry.
Tore up or something.
Hold everything. Hold him. Yellow backstretch. Jerry Baker, take it.
Well, let's go to number two, Sid.
Two, howdy.
That's right in front of us here, in front of VIP Suites, coming off the second turn. Tom Sneva spun, got into the outside wall. The car has come to stop just in front of us. There was some flame. The engine's torn completely off of the car. He was stunned, flipping around in the car. It got airborne, hit the wall, came to light right side up, right here in front of us. We're looking right down on it right at this moment. The fire department is there. They've got fuel on the car, got fire extinguisher stuff on the car. Tom, they're helping him out of the car. He is moving around. Let's see. They have the fire put out now. Other crew people are coming out to rush to the position right here. I don't believe any other car was involved. The engine is lying on the inside of the track straight across from us. The cars in the other cars out on the track are having to pull down into the infield.
All right, thank you, Luke. Everybody was standing up here. Did you see something on turn one, Ron?
Yes, Sid, I did. Wally Dahlenbach just went by us. Very
very, very slowly, and those telltale puffs of gray smoke coming up from the rear of that car. That's Wally Dallenbach, who was leader, and in car number 40. So you might watch more.
All right, let's see if he's slowing down. Jerry on the backstretch.
Yes, he's going very slowly, Sid. He is now into number three, and that big puff of smoke coming out the rear of the car. I'm sure Doug Zink can see him, Sid.
Take it, Doug.
And he's down below the white line. Another puff of smoke as he reaccelerates. He's may very well be, oh, big bunch of smoke now. He's over in turn four, Jim.
Okay, he's still trying to pour it on, but the smoke is pouring out. He's going to have to go into the pits. He's going to enter the pits just about right now, and that is a real shame. Now back to you, Sid.
Well, the engine conked out on Sam Sessions' car a few moments ago. He rolled in front of us with absolutely no power whatsoever, just coasting, and Dallenbach now comes in, and we see the car without any smoke trailing it, but he's slowly coming into the pit area. This race could well be stopped. In fact, there comes the rain pretty heavily. We're watching Pat Vidan. The yellow is out, and we're going to wait to make it official if he's going to pull out the red or not, which has to happen. Now it's pouring down rain. That's going to be it. And Bobby Unser from Albuquerque, New Mexico, may have weathered the storm, so to speak, and pushed himself into victory lane here by virtue of water.
The race would end, by the way, with a massive, massive downpour after 174 laps had been scored. Keith Jackson, who was filling in for Jim McKay. One thing of note here, Mike, we have talked about this earlier, but for clarification for folks, this was not because Jim McKay had any sort of a beef with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, rather a family commitment why Jim McKay was not there in 1975.
Yeah, that's right. Jim McKay's daughter was graduating from college, and so he asked for basically a personal day, which was a little bit unusual, and it was not part of any kind of beef as was thought at one time that was the case. So Keith Jackson filled in, but what's interesting about this clip is if you ever get the chance to watch this clip, there's an accident at the end with the cars are, you know, basically all spinning all off the road and everything because of the heavy rainstorm, and Bill Vukovich II actually spins off the track, backs up next to a fence, and then there's this random person who's inside the fence. He almost backs into the person, and then literally, as Jackie Stewart describes, Bill Vukovich just drives the car away. I mean, it was a very unusual scene at the end of the 75 race.
It's how it sounded in 1975.
Bobby Unser in the blue car on the right is the leader as they work their way so very carefully. At this point, however, remember, Bobby Unser must be very careful, because if he slides off the racetrack, he could still lose this race to Johnny Rutherford, who is feeling his way around. It's like walking on grease.
Remember, these drivers are not used to driving in the rain, and the cars are certainly not set up. I've driven in the rain, of course, a lot of times, because in Europe we do drive in the rain. But there we have tires, and there's cars all over the place. I just thought that with the aquaplaning and the amount of water on the road, cars are spinning, and look at this car.
That's Billy Vukovich.
Billy Vukovich trying to control it. He's heading for the infield. Oh, he's up on the fence, and he's coming up, and he's driving it away.
The red flag is up. The race is stopped. The checkered flag is up.
Mike, we've covered 1985, the spin to win with Danny Sullivan, and we've covered 1995. I know one of your favorite races was Jacques Villeneuve winning the race in terms of the anniversary years here in 2025. One thing that we haven't done, really, is taking a look back at the year 2000, which, as we talked about, was not only the turn, depending on whether you believe it to be in 00 or 01, but the era of the new changing of the millennium. But in addition to that, it was one, as we have talked about, where there were the politics of kind of the reacquaintance, if you will, between the split of the Indy Racing League and CART at the time. And this was the first year that you had one of the CART teams come over in Chip Ganassi Racing and bring with them a pretty darn good rookie, Mike.
Yeah, that's correct. And that was the beginning. 2000 was the beginning of the many happy returns, as I like to call it, as the folks that basically boycotted because of the split started to return. And 2000 was my return, actually. I was not there in 96, 97, 98, or 99. And 2000 was the first year I was back as well. So that was the beginning of many happy returns, actually, to the Speedway. And as you said, Montoya just was one of those guys you just took. There are people who just take to the Speedway immediately. And from the first time he was out there, Juan Montoya looked like a threat. And obviously on race day, he dominated. Him and Buddy Lazier were absolutely the class of the field that day.
The first time that Juan Montoya had visited the Indianapolis Motor Speedway came early in the year 2000 when he was at Chip Ganassi's racing shop on the northwest side of Indianapolis. He was getting fitted for a seat during a break in that activity. He went over to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and he got on the bus. He did one of the laps in the bus. He made it two laps, actually, became acquainted with it, and then in May of that year, he would dominate in the Indy 500.
Well, it does appear now that we will get all 200 laps in here today. Certainly that was questionable at 11 o'clock this morning when this race start was delayed by some 3 hours. However, now several hours later, it is 5:06 Indianapolis time, and we are closing in on the final two laps of this event. Juan Montoya from Bogota, Colombia, it appears now, unless, of course, something happens to that car, that he will park the Target Ganassi Racing machine in victory lane. 198 laps complete as he has now opened up more than a straightaway lead on second place Buddy Lazier. He has shown 7.5 seconds in front of Lazier as they head into turn number two. Make it three. Montoya heads to three.
And Juan Montoya running the same smooth line, the midway point of the back straightaway, and heads up along the wall in turn number three and heads towards the short chute. Again, coming through the short chute, our leader most of the day, Juan Montoya, has but one lap to go, and the rookie will pick up the checkered flag. The white flag is out now. One more lap to go.
White flag for Juan Montoya. He is all by himself right now as he heads into turn number one.
7 victories in kart last year. 7 poles. He's about to win the biggest prize in his history. He is in the second turn.
Talk about what seems to be the perfect mesh between man and machine. This guy has been brilliant. That car has been near perfect all day.
Climbed into an Indy car for the first time in March. It was a marriage that he became accustomed to very rapidly. Came within a couple of ticks to getting the pole. He's going to get the big prize, though, Bob Lamy, the Indy 500.
Yeah, his target is right on target. Coming through for Juan Montoya. Heads to the checkered flag. Call the finish, Mike King.
He may be a rookie, but he is for real. Flashbulbs capture the finish as Juan Montoya wins the 84th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race.
When you talk about, and there have been obviously a number of them, Mike, we've talked about it a lot on this program, but when you talk about somebody who just was a duck to water in terms of the feel of the Indy 500, one of my favorite stories, Mike, is Davey Hamilton has told me about when he was in that 2000 race, that Davey Hamilton was coming out of the pits and blending onto the backstretch, and he blended in right behind Montoya, and he was up to speed, and so he then, the next lap by, was following Montoya, and said as they were going into turn number three, Davey saw Montoya going almost sideways like a drifter car into the turn. And so Davey said that he realized, okay, I'm going to check my mirrors to make sure there's nobody on my outside so that I can go high, because he's going to hit the wall. And when he does, he's going to slide down. So I want to go to the outside here and go high so that by the time I get to the area where he is making the contact, he's going to be below me. Davey said literally Montoya was nearly sideways going into the turn. Davey checked his mirrors, looked up, and then couldn't figure out where he was. And he looked up and Montoya was going into turn number four. And he said, I've never seen anything like it in terms of how acclimated he was and how quick he was on reflex. Mike, Juan Montoya was a special, special talent.
Oh, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I think, you know, when we talk about the multiple winners, it's a little bit, he gets overlooked, I think, partially because, you know, he left for such a long time and did other things. I mean, he was successful in Formula One, he was successful in NASCAR, but I think he sometimes gets overlooked when we discuss Indianapolis 500 winners, and he shouldn't, because he was one of the absolute greats. There's no doubt about it.
The anniversary years, let's go back 20 years ago, which was a significant, a historical year at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and one that had fans on their feet late in the race of 2005. We'll let you hear about it and revisit it when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
In the construction business and can't find what you need, Quality Supply and Tool has served Hoosiers for over a quarter of a century. Tom Hawk is the branch manager of the Indy location on South Harding Street.
We've always been big on keeping our shelves fully stocked of inventory of industrial-grade tools, concrete, masonry products, as well as the necessary accessories to help get the job done. You don't have it, you can't sell it. Our experience allows us to help with getting the pros as well as the weekend pro taken care of.
Quality Supply and Tool also has locations in Bloomington and Jeffersonville to help you think outside the box. Store.
We'll be right back.
This is Beyond the Bricks, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
Jake Query, Mike Thompson, Eddie Garrison helping put everything together here for Beyond the Bricks as we take a look back at the anniversary years, 1975, the year 2000, 1925, 100 years ago, and 2005, which was 20 years ago. It was one of those races. It's always interesting to me, Mike, where one of the things that I think is so special about the race itself is each and every year when I go into the month, and then in particular on race morning, I have said many times what makes every race so special is you go into it and all you can think to yourself is we're going to see something today that people perhaps 100 years from now will still be talking about. And even if it's a race that seems relatively innocuous or uneventful in the era or in the year, it is a piece of history because there have only been, obviously to this point, 108 runnings of it. God willing, there will be 108 more. So each year you will talk about just the anomaly of a particular year. But sometimes a driver comes along that grabs the attention of all in the stands, and a driver could win the race that grabs the hearts of all of the stands. Maybe not even necessarily in the exact moment that it happens, but I think both took place in 2005.
No, there's no question about that. I mean, there's a couple times that we've heard the term mania. You know, there was Nigel Mania in 1993, and then there was no doubt about it. In 2005, there was Danica Mania. I mean, it absolutely was the case. Danica was mobbed wherever she went. And the fact is that you can have a mania, quote unquote, but if you don't deliver on the racetrack, you know, it's a little bit empty, right? And so she did. She delivered on the racetrack and was obviously a threat to win the race.
When you look at the rookie class of 2005, you know, Danica Patrick was, because of the fact that, you know, a female driver that was from the Midwest, a female driver driving for Ray Hall Letterman Lanigan Racing, a female driver that qualify in the top five, that alone jumps out. But then Ryan Briscoe in that rookie class, who would later go on to become a pole sitter at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway and drive for Roger Penske, Sebastian Bourdais in the rookie class. I think Bourdais is one of those, truth be told, Mike, that because he didn't necessarily run up front in Indianapolis on the consistent basis, maybe people forget just how overall accomplished in various levels Sebastian Bourdais was and what a big deal it was that he was running the Indy 500.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. Sebastian Bourdais had an incredible resume, great driver, and the fact is that he just didn't have an opportunity, I think, to really run up front at the Speedway. And then one of the best years I think he potentially had, you know, he had that terrible accident at the Speedway we all remember as well on qualifying day. So the fact is that, you know, look, Sebastian Bourdais is a great driver, and he's one of those guys that I think it would have been cool to see him in a really top echelon ride at the Speedway.
And because we do tip the cap and give a salute oftentimes to drivers throughout the course of Beyond the Bricks, want to point out also Sebastian Bourdais is truly one of the real gentlemen and good personalities that you can meet within IndyCar racing, and that's been around for quite some time now as, you know, a veteran driver who now is on to other ventures, but truly a really good guy. But with all of that said, let's go back to May the 29th of 2005. It was the 89th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. It led to, or had, I should say, a leader late in the race we talked about with Danica Patrick that suddenly captured the imagination of the crowd. And then a perhaps at the time lesser-known driver that would be the one to go on to win the race. This is how it sounded back in 2005.
We're going back to green flag racing. 190 of 200 laps will be complete this time by Danica Patrick going side by side with Weldon. She'll be the leader in turn number one.
Oh my goodness, they're three wide, but Patrick's got the lead. Mira has jumped up to third. Danica Patrick up front of the 500.
Crowd standing and cheering. Danica Patrick, she takes the lead off of turn number two. Dan Weldon right behind her. Then it's Vitor Mir in third.
She got great jump at the exit of turn number four. Used all that momentum down the straightaway. Fans on their feet, pumping fist in the air. Danica Patrick leads the way through three.
And she has about a six-car length lead. You know, Dan Weldon, when he's had the lead in the restarts, has struggled all day long, and he may have struggled on the biggest lap of the race.
Dan Weldon right now just doesn't have the speed to pull her down the straightaway into turn number one. It's Patrick by three-car lengths.
And there he does. Patrick through turn one. Weldon can't catch him. Neither can Mira. They're in the second corner.
These two battling for the lead has allowed Vitor Mira to close just a bit, but it continues to be a two-car dance for the lead. Danica Patrick leading to turn three.
Weldon takes a peek, decides wiser of it. Tucks right into the tire tracks. Already back in the short chute, the north end.
About a two-car length lead for the rookie out of Roscoe, Illinois. Danica Patrick about two cars ahead of Dan Weldon down the front straightaway.
Emberton, England's Dan Weldon. He's going to move to the inside of the Roscoe, Illinois native. They're side by side. Here. Weldon will try to take the lead into one.
And he will get the job done. Weldon put down to the white line. Now Patrick's going to play catch up.
For much of the late stages of this race, it has been the Dan and Danica show, but it will be Dan Weldon winning the 89th Indy 500 as an Englishman will roll into victory lane at the world's greatest race course for the first time in four decades.
Mike, I'll never forget after the race, of course, you know, it became kind of a gag, but Dan Weldon would make T-shirts that for Dan Weldon said actually won the Indy 500. Vitor Miera had a T-shirt that said Danica's teammate, because you are correct. When it comes to the Danica mania, that became such a massive storyline, and understandably so. You had a female driver that was leading. It doesn't matter, Mike, that it may have been partially strategy that put her up front and leading the race so late when Weldon would then pass her, and then the fact that I believe she still had one stop left to make. She still finished in the top five and led laps in that race. You can understand why all of a sudden everyone was talking about Danica Patrick.
Yeah, and I mean, don't forget the Sports Illustrated cover. She was on the cover of Sports Illustrated the next week, which used to be a thing that happened all the time. You know, the Indianapolis 500 would be on the cover of Sports Illustrated, and hadn't happened that often recently at that point. She's on the cover, and it says, yes, she can, and it's a really nice picture, and here she is. And then in the corner, it really small, it says Dan Weldon wins the Indy 500.
We knew Dan Weldon at that point because he was not a rookie. He had been around, and he was driving for, obviously, a top-flight team with Andretti at the time, but Andretti Green Racing at the time. But having said that, in 2005, it would be disingenuous to say that he was the transcendent beloved race car driver in terms of the personality yet, because I think it was really after he won that race in 05 and the way that he soaked in and appreciated it, that's what truly connected him with fans. And I think it would be after that race where the Dan Weldon that we knew that won it in 2011, we knew much better than the Dan Weldon who had won it in 2005. Hard to believe that it's been 10 years since our final clip. But if we're doing anniversaries of years that end in the five, then let's go back to 2015. A guy we talked about earlier, Juan Montoya, was about to set a record for the most years, or the biggest gap, I should say, between consecutive wins at Indianapolis for a driver. He had won it in 2000, Juan Montoya again in 2015.
Oh, and the spacing is good. Montoya comes close to the inside wall. The white flag is out. Montoya, Power, Kimball, Dixon.
Less than two and a half to go, and the two car is on its way. Juan Pablo Montoya, but it's not over yet, Jake.
If you got a giddy up to get on, you better do it now. Juan Montoya, Will Power right behind him. Power three car lengths back. Charlie Kimball in third. Montoya in the tournament three.
Oh, a car came off of pit road. It may figure a bit. It's to the bottom of the racetrack. Wilson, I believe it is, gets right back to the emergency lane. He's going to let the leaders battle it out.
Here comes Juan Pablo Montoya, two car lengths over Will Power. Who will win? Paul Page.
Montoya with Power right behind him. Power tries for a move. Montoya is going to win the 99th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Juan Montoya has raced here three times, and he has won twice.
Mike, a lot of fun. Sometimes you don't realize how fast the years go by until you listen to the montage, but a lot of fun listening to all of it that you put together tonight.
Yeah, absolutely. The time does fly, but it is fun to listen to all of it for sure. And that's another $100 for you.
That's right. The time flies, so too does the hour when we enjoy it on Beyond the Bricks.